It's the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule for Friday, October the 5th. I'm Phil Picardi. Today we hear Minnesotans may have been exposed to that dangerous form of meningitis. The trial of a Twin Cities terror suspect continues. Republicans want to get rich, she. And those who can teach, but how well? First, the Minnesota Department of Health says as many as 1,000 patients may have received contaminated steroids implicated in a national meningitis outbreak. Lorna Benson says two Twin Cities-based healthcare groups used steroids from the same product lots linked to the deaths of 5 patients and 30 illnesses in 6 other states.
Officials with medical advanced pain specialists and the Minnesota Surgery Center are scrambling to contact all of their patients who received the potentially contaminated steroid injections. Medical advanced pain specialists has locations in Edina, Fridley, Shakopee, and Maple Grove. The Minnesota Surgery Center has locations in Maple Grove and Edina. The steroids in question were used to treat back pain. The drugs were prepared by a specialty pharmacy in Massachusetts. That pharmacy, New England Compounding Center, has closed during the investigation and has voluntarily recalled the steroids it produced. But the U.S. Food and Drug Administration urged hospitals, clinics, and doctors in all of the affected states to discontinue use of any products made by NECC. State epidemiologist Ruth Linfield says Minnesota's priority is to make sure that patients who receive the steroid injections at medical advanced pain specialists or the Minnesota Surgery Center are notified quickly. Potential cases could go back as far as July. But Linfield says the health department is also keeping an eye on the bigger picture. The agency sent an alert to all Minnesota providers urging them to heed the FDA's advice and check their inventories for any products prepared by the Massachusetts pharmacy.
The active surveillance that we're doing, whereby we're calling patients, is for the patients who got this specific product. But clearly we're on the lookout and we're concerned about expanding, although at this point there's no evidence that it has expanded beyond this product.
One challenge for health officials in identifying the scope of this outbreak is that some of the meningitis cases have been mild. Linfield says when Tennessee health officials first identified the outbreak there, subsequent patient testing revealed that several people had contracted meningitis, but their symptoms were mild enough that they didn't seek medical care. She says those patients needed to be treated, though, particularly because their infections were in their spinal area.
The cases that have been reported have a fungal infection in their central nervous system, and some of them have had strokes associated with it, and others went on to develop severe symptoms. And so we are concerned.
If any Minnesota cases are identified in the days or weeks ahead, Linfield says those patients will likely need to be hospitalized so they can receive antifungal medication through an IV. Meningitis is an inflammation of the lining of the brain and spinal cord. Common symptoms of fungal meningitis infection may include headache, fever, sensitivity to light, a stiff neck, or pain at the injection site. Linfield says the good news is that this fungal form of the disease cannot be transmitted person to person.
That's Lorna Benson on the meningitis scare. An illness that is transmitted person to person is pertussis, or whooping cough. 190 new cases were confirmed in Minnesota in the past 2 weeks. That's nearly the same number of cases reported for just 1 week in September. The health department's Claudia Miller says it appears the pertussis outbreak is starting to slow down.
On a day-to-day basis, we're receiving somewhat fewer reports than we were over the past couple of months, but it's still considered epidemic levels, and we're still receiving new reports at levels much higher than in any recent years.
Pertussis causes a persistent, severe cough that sometimes lasts for months. Well, if it weren't for a skin rash, two Twin Cities men who traveled to Somalia to join radical insurgents might still be there today. Instead, the young men are cooperating witnesses for the federal government in the trial of a former janitor from Minneapolis. Defendant Mahmoud Saeed Omar is accused of helping send cash and fighters to the Somali terror group Al-Shabaab. Laura Ewan says the first witness took the stand yesterday and described how he and his friend escaped from an Al-Shabaab training camp.
Abdul Fattah Yusuf Issei was 24 when he found himself far from the comforts of his home in suburban Minneapolis and in the middle of nowhere. It was early 2008 in southern Somalia, and Issei says he was beginning to realize what he signed up for. He was at the intended site of an Al-Shabaab training camp, but Issei recalls there wasn't much there except a bunch of trees. He and the other trainees, including several others from the Twin Cities, were ordered to chop them down and clear the way for the camp. At night, the men slept on the ground. Issei found his ticket out when his friend, Salah Osman Ahmed of New Brighton, broke into a rash. Ahmed received permission from the camp's leader to seek medical treatment in the nearest city of Kismayo. Issei was allowed to accompany him. The two Minnesotans had been at the camp only for about a week. Issei and Ahmed eventually made their way back to the U.S. later that year. Issei's account provides the most detail yet on the Minneapolis recruit's travels in Somalia. He pleaded guilty 3 years ago to supporting Al-Shabaab, and yesterday, Issei acknowledged to the jury he's hoping to receive a lighter sentence in exchange for his testimony against defendant Mohamud Omar. He said before the first wave of men left Minneapolis in late 2007, he saw Omar hand about $500 in pocket money to another Al-Shabaab recruit and wished the men good luck on their journey. Prosecutors allege Omar helped Al-Shabaab by taking other men to the airport and helping secure their plane tickets. Issei is tall, with a chiseled face, and he recalled the less glamorous side of being an Al-Shabaab enlistee. At the safe house in the port city of Marka, the seven Twin Cities men slept on mattresses, four to a room. It was at this safe house where Issei said the defendant, Mohamud Omar, reunited with the Twin Cities men and stayed there for about a week. Issei said only people affiliated with Al-Shabaab were known to visit the safe house. Issei testified that before the first fighters left Minneapolis in 2007, about a dozen men held secret conversations about going to Somalia to, quote, wage jihad against the Ethiopian invaders. It was a reference to the Ethiopian troops that were invited by the faltering Somali government to help stabilize the country. At that time, Issei said he knew virtually nothing about Al-Shabaab, but did understand that he could be killed and that he might kill others. Omar's attorneys say their client is innocent and that he was too broke and unsophisticated to direct fighters and cash to a terrorist group.
NPR's Laura Ewan on the scene in Minneapolis. The King and Queen of Sweden began a three-day visit to the Twin Cities with a tour of the American-Swedish Institute in Minneapolis yesterday, Rupa Shenoy reports.
King Carl XVI Gustav and Queen Sylvia toured the American-Swedish Institute's newest green technology and recently installed gallery of tapestries. They visited with children learning traditional Swedish arts and crafts, including 10-year-old Alexander Love.
The queen helped me with my project. I thought they would come with their crowns, but, I mean, it might attract too much attention.
The royal couple will also visit Gustavus Adolphus College to mark the 150th anniversary of its founding by Swedish immigrants.
Rupa Shenoy on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Two Republican state lawmakers say DFL Secretary of State Mark Ritchie has gone too far in his criticism of the proposed voter ID constitutional amendment, which will be on the November ballot. Our Tim Pugmire says Senators Mike Perry of Waseca and Scott Newman of Hutchinson have filed a formal complaint accusing Ritchie of using public funds to campaign against voter ID and of spreading inaccurate information.
The complaint filed with the Office of Administrative Hearings accuses Ritchie of multiple violations of state campaign law. Perry and Newman, who have hired attorney Fritz Knack to represent them, claim that Ritchie traveled throughout the state in his official capacity and at taxpayer expense to promote what they view as his personal anti-voter ID agenda. They also claim he used those travels as well as his office's website to mislead voters about the impact of a new photo identification requirement. During a state capitol news conference, Newman said it's the Secretary of State's job to implement election laws without bias.
I don't view Mark Ritchie as being some type of an election cop whose responsibility is to protect the people of the state of Minnesota from the legislature's bill on this constitutional amendment. Neither do I believe that using his position as Secretary of State, has a job to try and influence the outcome of this ballot initiative.
Newman said he believes Ritchie misused public funds and illegally engaged in political activity as a state employee. He also contends the Secretary of State has repeatedly made false and misleading statements about voter ID, including that it will cost $50 million to implement and will end same-day voter registration. Newman also took issue with Ritchie's claim that the amendment could disenfranchise military voters.
Throughout all of the Senate hearings, the committee hearings, and on the floor of the Senate, we continue to deny that that was true. That has never been our intention. That is not going to happen.
Despite that intention, there is no reference to military voters in the amendment, and Republicans defeated several DFL attempts to add an exemption to the bill. The truth about many voter ID details won't be known until voters pass the amendment and next year's legislature decides how it's implemented. Still, Attorney Kanak said the Office of Administrative Hearings will soon try to determine the truth.
Some of this is a first impression. They're going to look at this, I'm sure, and try to make some determination as to, you know, how much of this is, frankly, allowed speech and how much of this is, in fact, factually inaccurate.
Similar allegations against Ritchie were first raised back in July when Senator Perry called a rare summer hearing of the State Government Innovation and Veterans Committee that he chairs. Ritchie didn't show up, and Perry hasn't forgotten the snub.
To me, that was arrogant on his part, not showing up, both him and the Attorney General. I mean, we could have solved this. And I just kept getting emails from the public. What are you going to do? Can you do something? You're the chairman. He falls under your authority. What can you do?
Perry, whose Senate term ends in 3 months, said he also wants the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board and the Office of the Legislative Auditor to look into Ritchie. He said those complaints could come later. Perry abruptly ended the news conference and left the room, even though reporters were still asking him questions. Democrats say the GOP complaint is off base. DFL Senator Chuck Wieger of Maplewood said he thinks Ritchie has the right and the duty to talk about voter ID.
To suggest that, you know, he has to, you know, just be mute on the issue and that there's some First Amendment gag order on his ability, I think is incorrect. And moreover, I would say he has a responsibility to do that.
Ritchie issued a statement saying he does not comment on litigation and that he will continue to work closely with local elections officials to ensure that the 2012 general election is efficient and accurate. Ritchie has previously insisted that he is not telling people how to vote on the constitutional amendment. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
Now, two reports about education. First, a new way to measure how well people are paying back their student loans is generating higher loan default rates for colleges. And that could make it tougher for some colleges to meet federal requirements, so says Alex Friedrich.
For years, federal officials looked at how well people managed loans within 2 years of leaving school. Now the feds have expanded that to 3 years, and loan default rates have jumped. State Office of Higher Education officials say that has put four Minnesota schools at or over the federal default limit of 25%. Hibbing Community College, Mesabi Range Community and Technical College, Cosmetology Careers Unlimited, and Duluth Business University. State analyst Tricia Grimes says exceeding the limit could have consequences.
If their default rate continues to be 25% or higher for 3 years in a row, they could lose eligibility to have their students receive all federal student aid.
Colleges may also face default management plans.
Alex Friedrich there, now Tim Post. He has a report about evaluating teachers. A new evaluation system was a key point of dispute that led to the recent Chicago teacher strike, and Minnesota is in the early stages of putting together its own new statewide teacher evaluation system.
At the moment, job evaluations are hit or miss for Minnesota teachers. Tom Dewar, the president of the state's Teachers Union Education Minnesota, says some school districts offer teachers regular reviews of their work. Others do not.
The stories are horrible about maybe 10, 15 years without an observation or an evaluation, which we think is wrong.
That's about to change. A law passed 2 years ago will require all of Minnesota's more than 50,000 public school teachers to be evaluated on a yearly basis, starting in the 2014-2015 school year. The Minnesota Department of Education is figuring out the details now with help from a 40-person working group. Right now, the group is wrestling with a major piece of the new teacher evaluation system. How should student test scores reflect a teacher's effectiveness? The new law says 35% of a teacher's evaluation must be judged on how well students do. The Chicago teacher strike revolved around a similar point. Teachers feared their jobs might be in jeopardy if students in their class or their school didn't perform well. There are similarities between the Chicago system and what Minnesota is developing, but Dewar thinks Minnesota's system will turn out better.
So I think ours is fairer. It's more about development. It's more about effectiveness. And it's more about how do we do this in a way that is going to help the educators become better.
The new Minnesota teacher evaluations will likely be modeled in part on systems already in place, like one in the St. Paul School District. Tim Kasky is Executive Director of Human Resources for St. Paul Public Schools.
On a regular basis, our principals are in classrooms making notes around observations of what they see teachers do.
The St. Paul evaluations focus on how teachers manage their classroom, interact with students, and teach to state standards. The evaluations can help identify what a teacher is doing well and where they may need extra training or mentoring. But Sharon Freeman, an assistant superintendent in St. Paul, says the system is not about punishing teachers.
So it's not a got you. It's around making sure that teachers are at their best when teaching our children.
The St. Paul system could be seen as an example of the supportive side of teacher evaluations. But the state evaluation system will also need to evaluate teachers on student performance and identify poor-performing teachers who shouldn't be in the classroom. Jim Bartholomew is Education Policy Director for the Minnesota Business Partnership. He's also a member of the working group that's developing the new statewide evaluations and is one of the few people from outside education in the group. He agrees with the state's teachers union that teacher evaluation should help teachers do their best, but he also wants to see a system that acknowledges there's a time for teachers to leave.
If you do all of that and they still don't get to where they need to go, we have to be able to say it's time to look for another profession, perhaps.
Just what the final version of Minnesota's teacher evaluation system looks like will be ironed out in coming months. In the meantime, school administrators are raising alarms about one missing component, funding. Gary Amoroso, executive director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, says schools may have to shift money around in order to train teachers and principals to use the system.
And that could, depending on the district, have a negative impact on the students in the classroom.
At a time of tight funding, educators warn any shift in resources can result in larger class sizes or other cuts in curriculum. Amoroso hopes funding is something lawmakers consider next session, 2 years before the teacher evaluation system is put in place.
That's Tim Post on his favorite podcast, the NPR News Update. I hope you like accessing the best of Minnesota Public Radio's offerings on your schedule. We will post it again next week.